This is East End Inc. Tonight we present author, editor, and writing teacher Suzanne McConnell talking about Pity the Reader, The Art and Craft of Writing by Kurt Vonnegut, co-written by McConnell, his former student. Suzanne McConnell was a student of Kurt Vonnegut's at the Iowa Writers' Workshop from 1965 to 1967, when Vonnegut was in residence and finishing his masterpiece, Slaughterhouse-Five. Suzanne McConnell was recorded at Canio's Books in Sag Harbor in November of 2019.
I'm going to start by telling you my vision of Kurt Vonnegut. So I was about 22. He was 42. He was teaching at the workshop. He had written 4 books, I think. And when I walked into the classroom, it was a class called Form of Fiction that everyone had to take, and it was team taught. So there were 3 writers in front of the class, all men, of course. There were no women teachers there at the time. And here was this man, I'd never heard of him before, and he was standing in front of the class, and he was smoking a... To connect with wanting cigarettes here, he was smoking in a cigarette holder, holding a long black cigarette holder, and in the book I describe this, and I say that there was something comical. He just struck my funny bone right away, because here he is, this long, tall, skinny guy, and somewhere or other he described himself as a man shaped like a banana, which he kind of was, and even then he was 42, but he was still a man shaped like a banana. And he looked like he knew what he was doing, that he had this pose. But he actually was also, at the time, some of you will remember, there was this myth that if you smoked with a cigarette holder, you didn't get as much tobacco? I don't know. So he was trying to quit smoking even then. I'm going to tell you a little bit about how this book came about, and maybe how it can be read, because it's a very odd book. So it came about because Dan Wakefield, who was a writer, he was once the editor of a fiction editor at Atlantic Monthly, but he was a friend of Kurt's, much younger. But they both went to the same high school in Shortridge High School in Indianapolis, and were great friends. And he put together a book of Vonnegut's speeches, If This Isn't Nice, What Is? And he also put together a volume of Vonnegut's letters. He was in his 80s doing this, and it was a real labor of love, because Kurt wrote letters like crazy all his life. And he insisted on putting introductions to each letter, so he was exhausted. And he was supposed to do a book on Vonnegut's writing advice. And I had met him during the letters book and also at Kurt's memorial service. And so he called me up and said, and left a message, I have an opportunity for you. And you know, when that call comes or somebody saying an opportunity, you go, what is that, you know? But for me, that opportunity came at an absolutely perfect time. And I felt like Kurt had reached down from the heaven he didn't believe in and tapped me on the shoulder. And I actually felt that all the way through writing this book. I still feel it. I feel like he was really giving me this job to do. So I feel quite blessed by that. So I was told 65 to 75% of it had to be his words, and I could do anything I wanted. So that was quite a large, daunting task. So I started out by reading everything, but I also started out knowing quite a bit about him and about his whole history and his sense about writing, because I was his student. And when we were his students, everyone gossiped about what their teachers had been through, and we knew something about them. So we all knew pretty quickly that he had been, his backstory was Slaughterhouse-Five, that he had been a German-American or German heritage American, in World War II at age 20, taken prisoner quite quickly, and then taken to a prison camp, and then taken underground when the Americans and Allies began bombing Dresden, and that he'd come up to that. So we knew that. And so I knew, without having to do any much research, the kind of his fundamental ideas about writing, that he was passionate about it, that he was passionate about caring about things. But I also had taken out of the New York Times in about, I don't know, 1983, when I started teaching at Hunter, a piece that was in the newspaper that was actually a paper company had given an assignment to about 10 different people to write different things, different how-to things, how to write a speech, how to blah, blah, blah. And his was how to write with style. So it is now on the end pages of this book. It's in the front and the back. So for years, I handed this out to every class I ever taught. It's not about writing fiction. It's about how to write anything. And his first, Anita, do you remember this at all? Probably not. No, it's a bad question. Okay. But, my dear, how could you not? So his first rule, and it's a really fundamental rule, is find a subject you care about, which sounds like elementary. Why wouldn't you? But people don't always do that. They don't always start there. They start some other place, like what should I write, or what will make money, or some other place. So his is find a subject you care about, and then the next part of the sentence is, and which you in your heart feel others should care about. So those are pretty profound things. So the book is narrative in two ways. One is it's narrative as it follows that idea for a writer. So there's a whole bunch of like things about pitfalls and the downside of caring about things and so on. But the other narrative is starting with Vonnegut's caring so much about trying to write about Dresden, which took, you know, he was writing Slaughterhouse-Five while we were at Iowa, so it took him that long. It took him 25 years. Wilfred Sheed said of Vonnegut, he won't be trussed up by an ism, even a good one. He preferred to play his politics and even his pacifism by ear. Vonnegut was prone to seeing the other side of the coin, ambiguity and contradiction. He had, after all, been captured, imprisoned, and forced into labor carting corpses by an enemy regime rotten with idolatry, decayed by a people's desire for easy authoritarian solutions. He would appreciate this palindrome by Swiss artist André Tompkins, dogma, I am God. For my part, I want to avert as much as possible my own and the reader's impulse to make dogma out of Kurt Vonnegut's advice. One way I hope to accomplish that is by adopting the concept of endarkenment. It is borrowed from Profound Simplicity by Will Schutz, published in 1971. Quote, the one book that gives meaning to the human potential movement, according to the cover. Schutz, a leading psychiatrist in that movement, lists all of his credentials. He'd done everything. He'd led innumerable seminars at Esalen and so on. It's a concise, down-to-earth, truly helpful book, presently out of print. But the part that has stuck with me for 40 years is his final chapter, Endarkenment. It begins, sometimes my striving toward growth becomes the object of amusement to the part of me that is watching me. He tired occasionally of that striving and rebelled, so he devised a workshop called Endarkenment. In it, the participants were encouraged to be devious, superficial, and to wallow in their self-made misery. They drank hard, smoked like chimneys, stuffed themselves with junk food, and blamed everybody else for their problems, starting with the other workshop members all the way up to Almighty God. In teaching sessions, each person divulged their worst trait and explained how the others could acquire it. One man said he never finished things. He promised he'd teach the group how to do that the following Wednesday. When Wednesday came, he had dropped out of the workshop. The results of the Endarkin workshops were pretty startling because they were as effective as the regular workshops in raising people's awareness of the human comedy and in realizing that they themselves chose what they did and that therefore they could make other choices. So I have adapted that word and redefined it to use it as a guiding principle. When alternatives, ironies, warnings about, or contradictions to previous advice or ideas pop up, that concept is at work. So originally, all the way through the book, there were these places that there are marks that my publisher came up with, my designer came up, it's very nice, these little tildes sort of in the book, between things. I had another mark, and I had put endarkinment every time I saw something that was opposite, I had marked it in a certain kind of way, too, to set it off. So it became a little obtrusive, so he took that out. So just know when you're reading it, just be aware that that concept is here, even though there's not a, it's, this ghost is gone. It's only a couple of people been puzzled by this title. Do you want to know about the title? Yes. What do you think it means? Pity the reader.
Putting up with the reader? Yeah, well, the reader pity the author because you have to put up with me. I'm the writer.
The reader has to put up with you. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Well, you do exactly, and that's precisely what the point is. Pity the reader is one of his little rules here, but it really means a bunch of things. It means be courteous. Be courteous to the reader. I've found a lot of quotes about reading, really interestingly enough, how hard it is to read, and how you have to make the job for the reader easy. And on and on about that. I have two assignments in the book that he gave us, I kept all those years. And at the end of one, it says, do not bubble. Do not spin your wheels. Use words I know. I love that. Do not bubble. Okay, I'm going to read a chapter that's kind of like the quintessential chapter before all the chapters on craft, and it's kind of the nugget. And it goes along with Pity the Reader. It's called The Mother of All Pearls. This was once called Vonnegut's Pearls, which was not a good title either, but. Picture a huge luminescent pearl, its gleam so great that its glow prevails over all the lesser pearls nestled around it. Well, here is the mother of all pearls of wisdom that Kurt offered us at Iowa on the nuts and bolts of writing fiction. You're in the entertainment business. He stood in front of the class, shaking his head over someone's story as he said that many times. This was startling to hear. Entertainment business implied Hollywood with its crass glitter and flash. I myself was not thinking about entertaining anyone. I just wanted to get sorrow and outrage off my chest. Everyone in the workshop had things to get off their chests. Our instructors did too. It seemed like Kurt had the most. He was writing Slaughterhouse-Five. We knew his firebombing prisoner of war backstory. These were soul-scouring experiences, and we were in the entertainment business. Eventually, I understood he meant this. You have to play by the rules of fiction well enough so that you can get across what is in the rag and bone shop of your heart. You have to be like a magician or pickpocket, distracting the audience by entertaining while you are really saying those things you most want to say. At a party recently, I told two MFA candidates that this was Kurt's most important advice. They stared at me aghast. One of the hardest lessons for novice writers to realize is that caring alone, no matter what you've been through or what story you have to tell, doesn't matter in terms of rendering the successful creation of your work. It's not your story that matters. It's how you tell it. Your story matters. You know what I'm talking about. I'm talking about how you tell it in terms of craft. Vonnegut knew the distinction between spinning a yarn and the voltage that caused the yarn to spin, between the self and the persona. Of all he taught about writing, what he said about the entertainment business, I would come to discover, was the most important and complex.
This is East End Inc. We're listening to Suzanne McConnell talking about Kurt Vonnegut and Pity the Reader, the book she co-wrote with Vonnegut.
I'm going to read you a couple of other little things, like, just to give you a little tidbit of the book. So this is a chapter on plot. What keeps a reader reading? Which is the first job you have to do. Howard Campbell, the narrator of Mother Night, clues us in. So this is from Mother Night. I froze. It was not guilt that froze me. It was not a ghastly sense of loss that froze me. It was not a loathing of death that froze me. It was not heartbroken rage against injustice that froze me. It was not the thought that I was so unloved that froze me. What froze me was the fact that I had absolutely no reason to move in any direction. What had made me move through so many dead and pointless years was curiosity. Okay, back to me. That's the same thing that keeps a reader reading. Plot, the very concept and the structure of any plot, relies on the reader's curiosity. I just finished reading about a 450-page novel by André Dubuis, in which, Gone So Long, anybody read that? He keeps you wondering through the entire book. It's two people, estranged father who has murdered the mother of the daughter, and they haven't seen each other, of course, in lo those many years. And through the entire book, they're going to meet. And they meet in the last. And I was just wowed by that. He keeps you going because you don't know what's going to happen, all those pages. Vonnegut's Creative Writing 101, rule number 3, is every character should want something, even if it's only a glass of water. Wanting something, anything, triggers curiosity and suspense. Will the character get what she desires or not? Vonnegut told us in class that even a small problem would keep a reader reading. And he used to tell us this story about there was a nun who took classes there. Everybody would talk about the nun in the classes. And She wrote a story in which there was a character had a piece of dental floss stuck in their tooth. Would she ever get it out? Kurt was so delighted with that. He used that detail to talk about suspense and plot forever after. I think he was amazed at his own curiosity about the stuck floss pulled him along in the story. And here's a quote from him. Nobody could read that story with fishing around in his mouth with a finger. When you exclude plot, when you exclude anyone's wanting anything, you exclude the reader, which is a mean-spirited thing to do. More complex, vital things may be occurring. The nun may be battling cancer or want to break out of her habit, for example, but this basic will she or won't she get what she wants is a scaffold upon which those complexities can be built. One of the things I found out reading all of Vonnegut, and reading it the way I was reading it, which was not reading for plot. If anybody asks me, I won't know the plot, probably. I'll know something he said about writing. Was how much he loved music. Because I never would have thought this before, but he uses it all the time in different ways. So there's a chapter about that, about prose the audio. In which I quote some of his things, like here's one from Welcome to the Monkey House. Suddenly he struck, and a spasm of dirty, low-down, gorgeous jazz shook the air, a hot, clanging wraith of the 20s. And sometimes he uses it in my endarkenment sense, like he uses it as an irony. Like the title of Player Piano is exactly that. I mean, Player Piano is a mechanical thing that makes music. And that whole book is about automation. Here's something from Mother Night. There was one announcement that was always crooned like a nursery rhyme. Many times a day it came. It was the call for the Sonderkommando. And in Galapagos, when burying the dead, he uses this phrase as comfort. Oh, well, he wasn't going to write Beethoven's Ninth Symphony anyway. Well, I'll just say, read this one thing. My point. Language is a kind of music. Silence at play with sound. Cadence, beats, accents, and tone. The vocal cords, throat, tongue, nose, lips, our amazing apparatus for speech is the same as for singing. The writer's problem is you have to make that sound on the page without any sound. I'm going to read two more things. This is from a chapter on black humor, because I couldn't write about Vonnegut's advice on writing without talking about humor. So there's two chapters. One is regular goofy humor, which he did more of than I had ever realized. And this one, I'm just going to read a couple of pages here. This is a quote from Bluebeard. I had made her so unhappy that she had developed a sense of humor, which she certainly didn't have when I married her. This line from Bluebeard's narrator remarks on black humor. Vonnegut is best known for. Its source is helplessness and despair. He explains, laughter or crying is what a human being does when there's nothing else he can do. A scene in Cat's Cradle, this is me, illustrates it as well as any in Vonnegut's work. The character Philip Castle is telling another about a catastrophic shipwreck off the fictional island of San Lorenzo, awash a load of people on shore. Quote, at Father's hospital, we had 1,400 deaths inside of 10 days. Have you ever seen anyone die of bubonic plague? He describes blackened bodies, swollen glands, stacks of dead, which I skipped. Father worked without sleep for days, worked not only without sleep, but without saving many lives either. Anyway, one sleepless night, I stayed up with Father while he worked. It was all we could do to find a live street. In bed after bed, we found dead people. And Father started giggling, Castle continued. He couldn't stop. He walked out into the night with his flashlight. He was still giggling. He was making the flashlight beam dance over all the dead people stacked outside. He put his hand on my head, and do you know what that marvelous man said to me? Asked Castle. Nope. Son, my father said to me, someday this will all be yours. This quintessential Vonnegut mousetrap, dark, he was describing in an earlier chapter that he wrote in jokes, and it's like a mousetrap. Set the trap, blah, 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 pull somebody in, bing. This quintessential Vonnegut mousetrap, darkest pitch, funny as hell, is well known to Vonnegut fans. Let me tell you how one of those fans employs it. Like Jon Stewart, who said when introducing Kurt on The Daily Show that as an adolescent he made my life bearable, Joshua confided at a fledgling Vonnegut book club in New York that Vonnegut's books had saved him as a teenager. When he discovered that Vonnegut had majored in anthropology, he did too. What has he done with that degree? Worked all over the globe for NGOs, starting in Sri Lanka during their civil war, first working for an organization that assisted victims on one side of the conflict, then for an organization that assisted the other side. A very Vonnegut-like thing to do, indeed. Kurt would have loved that. He'd be proud. He'd laugh. At that moment, when I met him, he was working to rebuild houses of people hit hard by Hurricane Sandy. A year or so later, he sent me the following email. I'm writing from the disputed Ukrainian-Russian border. I am working for the Danish Refugees Council, leading the planning and implementation of shelter for Ukrainian refugees displaced by the conflict. I thought of you today when I quoted Vonnegut. I was orienting a new aid worker. I told him, someday this could all be yours. So this whole chapter is about him as a teacher. When we were your students, you let us work it out for ourselves, Gail Godwin told him, yet your being there for us did the trick. trusting is a two-way street. All he did in those classes and conferences was to trust us. He trusted that we were working out our tapes at our own pace in our own ways, and what would come, or it wouldn't. I've been having trouble concluding this topic. Kurt Vonnegut taught me about so much more than writing. At a time when I sorely needed models to know that one could keep on trucking, one could even thrive, in spite of personal and societal traumas, he was there, a template, teaching and writing. What he taught was more important than writing. He led us to abhor war, to be compassionate toward our characters, to respect people, to question rigid constructs, to care deeply, to try to be decent, to laugh, to tell useful lies. He taught these things by his responses to people's stories, by his anecdotes, by his quiet remarks, by his treatment of us, and by being himself. I sang gospel every few weeks at a friend's loft in Soho in the 80s with a loose group of superb singers. We sang a cappella. We riffed and harmonized. One night, someone suggested that one person hold a single note while the others kept harmonizing. It seemed like a boring static part to take, so I didn't volunteer. But when my own turn came, I discovered that holding one note while all the other voices were moving up and down and around, not only took a fierce focus, but felt physical, as though I were a ridgepole holding up the rest of a swaying tent, threatening to pull to one side and then the other. That's what Kurt Vonnegut was like to me, a singular sustaining note.
This is East End Inc. We heard Suzanne McConnell talking about Kurt Vonnegut and Pity the Reader, the book she co-wrote with Vonnegut. The book was published in 2019 by Seven Stories Press. The nonprofit Canio's Cultural Cafe at 290 Main Street, Sag Harbor, presents the following free literary events. On Saturday, February the 8th at 4 p.m., an African-American literature read-in, co-sponsored with Sag Harbor's John Germain Library. You may read a short story excerpt by your favorite black author by registering to read at 631-725-4926. 631-725-4926. On Sunday, February 23rd at 3 p.m., 21st Century Spirituality, a discussion of Richard Rohr's The Universal Christ with Professor Thomas Petriano and Reverend Ida Lorello. And on Saturday, March 28th at 5 p.m., author, poet, and farmer Scott Chasky reads from his work, Surveying 30 Years in Community-Supported Organic Farming and More. East End Inc. is heard on the fourth and occasional fifth Wednesday of each month. The programs are archived at eastendinc.blogspot.com. Podcasts are available at soundcloud.com. Search for East End Inc. And today's program was produced by Tony Ernst with the aid of Canio's Marianne Calendrill and Catherine Shokin.